The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Let's go ahead and turn over to Revelation and chapter 13. Revelation 13. Today's sermon falls into the category of prophecy, or should I say understanding prophecy. Most people enjoy sermons about prophecy. We find it very interesting and quite fascinating, as long as you know you understand it, or at least hopefully it helps to give you a better understanding. But a prominent element in biblical prophecy is Babylon. Babylon has been a significant empire throughout history. This is recognized even by secular historians and secular folks who give little credibility to the Bible, but they are forced to accept the evidence archaeologically and otherwise that is found throughout, or has been found throughout, the Middle East. There are massive complexes that have been uncovered in Iraq that reveal how significant the capital of Babylon once was. There are petroglyphs and hieroglyphs in Assyria and in Egypt, all through history. And most of the information that comes to us about Babylon of old, aside from the Bible, comes from approximately 1,750 cuneiform tablets that have been found throughout the decades, or perhaps maybe a century or two. And these tablets contain a vast amount of information about ancient Babylon, about its culture, its religion, its commerce, its wars, history of that empire. Now, within those tablets, interestingly, there is a Babylonian version of creation. It's found in a set of tablets called the Enuma Elish, also known as the Seven Tablets of Creation. And in that account, their chief deity, Marduk, is a conqueror of many lesser gods as he was creating the world before he created mankind. Sounds very similar to what happened actually between God and Lucifer and the rebellious angels. They also have their own version of the Great Flood that is found in the Tale of Gilgamesh. Some of you may have heard of that and not known where it came from. Yeah, it came from Babylonian tablets. And in that account, the reason their gods destroyed all of mankind and caused a flood and saving only a select few was not because the world was filled with violence and evil, as the Bible says, but because all of the noise from the people on the earth, all the noise they were making in their in the commotion, the building projects or what have you, it didn't allow those gods to get enough rest. So they were upset about that and decided to kill everybody. Obviously, a fanciful tale, or else this world would have been destroyed again and again and again many times over. So there are hundreds of tablets from Babylon telling of war, of peace, of the infrastructure, the religion, the commerce, all those things that would be related to a great nation or empire. Now, the Bible tells us that the beginning of Babylon was through a mighty hunter known as Nimrod. And this man, Nimrod, he was a descendant of Ham through his son Cush. And Nimrod became a legend through fanciful tales, making him out to be a supernaturally powerful, likened to a god. It's said that Nimrod is actually the source of 1,000 other gods down through history. They all arose centuries after the flood. Babylon continued into the age of establishing Israel as a nation in the land of Canaan. Nebuchadnezzar was one of Babylon's leaders, a significant king who was the leader during the time of the fall of the southern kingdom, the house of Judah. And there are a collection of about 200 tablets, within those Babylonian historical tablets, that they are dated back to the 6th and 5th centuries B.C., documenting the exiled Judean community coming to Babylon following the destruction of the Israelite temple. They contain information on the physical condition of those people that were brought into Babylon as captives, their financial situation. And those tablets are actually named after a central settlement in Babylon called El-Yehudu, which in Akkadian means the town of Judah. During those years of captivity, Daniel was presented with the task of interpreting a recurring dream of King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of a stunning image that had a head of gold, a chest of arms, and a chest and arms of silver, loins of brass, legs of iron, and then feet that was a mixture of iron and clay. Now, that image we recognize and understand is symbolic of empires down through history. And the head of gold portrayed the Babylonian Empire. Now, the gold symbolized the excellence and the glory of that empire, but not morally. It was through a secular lens. And so God, however, did indicate that it was he who actually allowed for that empire to become prominent and allowed even for Nebuchadnezzar to be part of such a spectacular empire. The Babylonian Empire was portrayed also in a vision that Daniel had of four beasts coming out of the sea, and the sea in that vision portray nations, people on the earth. And the lion, one of those beasts that came out of the sea, represents Babylon. Now, that lion is directly related to the first head of the beast that is mentioned in Revelation chapter 13. And I'm going to read the first three verses here. Revelation 13, verses 1 through 3. Then I stood on the sand of the sea. This is John's vision now. I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. Again, sea portraying people, nations, having seven heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Now, when we read this account here, we see that this beast has all the similarities of the beasts that Daniel saw in his vision. It speaks of a leopard, which was one of those beasts that Daniel saw. It speaks of, there's quite a loud siren going by. Yeah, fire truck. I saw that. It speaks of the feet of a bear, which is another one of the beasts that Daniel saw, and also the mouth of a lion, which is one of the beasts Daniel saw. And then it talks about this dragon giving him power, and this, I think, is related to the beast that was more powerful than all the others that Daniel saw. And we understand the representation of the dragon, that great dragon, the devil, who deceives the whole world. He is the inspiration behind these godless empires. And so the heads of this beast, seven of them, portray different stages or eras of the Roman Empire down through time. However, it has the characteristics of these other four empires of Daniel's vision. And this indicates that the final beast, a beast actually representing an empire, a powerful nation or government, this final beast would not only subdue previous empires that had come before it, but it assimilated various aspects of the culture and the religions of the kingdoms that it conquers. And all of those, every one of those, assimilated culture and religion from Babylon. Now, the fatal wound being healed here, this represents the fact that though seemingly non-existent today, this empire will arise again, and it will be a significant player among the nations and during end time events as they begin and as they unfold. If you go over a page or two just to Revelation 17, now much of what I am mentioning here today, I'm summarizing quite a bit, summarizing many things that can be found in greater detail in a series of Bible studies that we had given in the past on the book of Daniel, and we also gave a series of Bible studies on the book of Revelation, and those series of studies can be found on our website. You can listen to them or even request a copy on a single CD if you are able to play MP3s. They're also available, or more information about these subjects that I'm mentioning today can be found in our booklets of Understanding the Mark of the Beast, and the other one, Keys to Understanding Revelation. Revelation 17 describes a decadent woman dressed in purple, scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones. She rides a scarlet beast that has seven heads and ten horns, like we had read here in Revelation 13. Now, this woman that rides this beast, we're familiar with the description of her, and we'll read a bit of that in a moment. She is considered to be more than promiscuous, but not necessarily sexually. It's in a religious manner. It says that both the woman and the beast are full of the names of blasphemy. And so we are reminded, therefore, in this description of the connection between adultery and idolatry when we consider this woman and the beast that she rides. It says, I'll just go ahead and read a portion of it here. And let's see. Yeah, we'll go ahead and read verse 1. Come, and I'm going to begin through partway through. Come, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And in verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. So this golden cup here, the filthiness of her fornication, these are clues showing us her connection, her and the beast's connection to Babylon. And it's blatantly stated in the next verse, verse 5, where it says, and on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Now, to most people, the enduring influence of Babylon upon the nations, it's a mystery. They don't understand it. They don't know it. But with biblical insight, with the study of history, and by being led by the Spirit of God, we can do research into this. This history of nations, of idolatry, of paganism, and even into false Christianity, looking at the history of those things that most people that claiming to be Christian practice. And we can know what various aspects of that mystery is, so that it's not a mystery to us any longer. The mystery is twofold, actually. You could put it into two categories. And the first part is Mystery Babylon's relationship to most nations down through time. And the second part is the religious influence that Babylon's diversity of practices has had on nearly every religion unto this very day, including most sects of Christianity. Now, I'm not going to go into all these details about this, about its connections to the nations and religions politically, religiously, but I would like to focus on a few things that may not be understood by some of us. Now, first, what may be puzzling to some is use of the term great, Babylon the Great. You know, when we say something is great, it usually means that it's positive. We very much enjoy it. It's a wonderful thing. It's a benefit in some or significant way or many ways, or even something that's positively famous. But that's not always the case when the use of this term, translated as great, is found in the Bible in the Greek. So the Greek original term, it comes from the Greek megas. Now, we are familiar with the expression mega. We use that in the English language today. It's an adjective. It means that something is very big, large, or loud, or exceedingly strong. And though that can have a positive connotation, it's not always a good thing, is it? No. There can be mega disasters, mega epidemics, mega destruction. I'm reminded of a thrash metal band called Megadeth. And some might argue, well, the music of Megadeth is very positive in their opinion, but the concept of Megadeth is not a good thing, is it? Let's put a ribbon here in Revelation and go all the way back to the first book of the Bible, Genesis 10. Genesis chapter 10. So the use of mega, translated as great, in these contexts, when it refers to Babylon, it's similar to the use of a term that's translated in the English, mighty. So there is a description of Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10, calling him a mighty individual. Let's go ahead and read Genesis 10, verses 8 through, well, let's just begin in verse 8. So it says that Cush, which was the son of Ham, that Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. And therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Eternal. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And it gives a few other names as well, but Babel became the most famous, or in our opinion, infamous one. And so we know where this led. You know, Nimrod may have been very strong and powerful and a great leader. But to us, he's only great in the sense of being notorious. You know, the mighty one, this expression, mighty one, it's the Hebrew gibur, meaning a powerful warrior tyrant. That's not very positive. So God descriptively connects Nimrod, the mighty hunter, and his religious government of Babel to the empire of Babylon. And that can be found if you turn over to Jeremiah. Jeremiah in chapter 5. We will see a description of that. Speaking of a prophecy of an actual event that did occur, that God allowed to happen. Jeremiah 5. In verse 15, God is talking about judgment on the wicked people of Judea. And it says in Jeremiah 5, verse 15, "Behold, I will bring a nation against you from afar, O house of Israel." This is talking about the house of Israel, not the house of Judah. Pardon me. So God says, "I'll bring against you from afar, O house of Israel," says the Eternal. "It is a mighty nation. It is an ancient nation, a nation whose language you do not know, nor can you understand what they say. Their quiver is like an open tomb. They are all mighty men." So this description of these people, it's not positive. They were not nice. Like Nimrod, God allowed them to come down and to conquer Israel, They were strong, they were cunning, they were powerful, perhaps great leaders. But interestingly, like I had mentioned about when the description of Nimrod, it's this the use of this term Gibor. And it's used to describe people also, it is used to describe people before the flood. Men of old, mighty men of renown, it says. And these are that's a description of men that were tyrants. They were violent, they were bloodthirsty, lustful. And they enjoyed it. They enjoyed that type of behavior and attitude and activity. So let's go back to Revelation 17. I hope this helps us to understand that Babylon the Great is a term describing an empire that is extensive, but not in a positive way. Oh, some that people would argue that. People would say, oh, I've benefited greatly. And we'll get into more about that a bit later. I've benefited greatly from that empire and that government. But in the long run, it has adversely affected towns, cities, governments, nations, and religions for thousands of years. So the revival of this beastly empire will continue to display effects of its mystery religion, which we understand it's not a single religion. It accepts a variety of different forms of religions and just tries to integrate them all. When we had read the description in Revelation 17, we see the woman that she's riding a beast, and the woman riding this beast, she portrays an apostate church that, like a harlot, has had intimate relations with idols, but also with kings, presidents, governors, queens, priests, an innumerable amount of people for millenniums. Now, few realize, though, that the origin has always been Babylon. It can always be traced back to Babylon. And most do not know, actually, that they are practicing ancient heathen ways. And that's one of the facets of the mystery. Some who do know will read perhaps, you know, a booklet, one of ours or one like ours, explaining some of the connections here. They might see that information and go, oh, yeah, they can't deny that it has a connection, but they'll turn around and claim, well, it's different today. You know, we've confiscated those things for Christ, and it's those things are okay now. But the genuine Church of God, she is also referred to as a woman. She is referred to as a bride, a wife preparing herself for marriage at this time. And the body of this bride consists of individuals that are described as being virgins, spiritually, that is, religiously undefiled. Now, the woman riding the beast is the bride's nemesis, if you will. She is defiled by numerous acts of religious fornication, continually giving birth to who knows how many harlots. It calls her the mother of harlots, false religions, false churches. And those daughters, well, they are also defiled, clearly. And they're defiled by, again, that mystery religion, mystery Babylon, the great, their mother. Now, this mother not only represents many versions of false religion, the beast with seven heads and with 10 horns portrays eras of specific empires and nations, meaning that you know that she has a structured and supports a structured form of government. She's not entirely lawless, just lawless against the ways of God. She engages and she supports commerce. She facilitates an exchange of goods, housing, law enforcement, infrastructure. And for this reason, she is also described as a great city. In chapter 17, in verse 18, it says, "And the woman who you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." And that is where the symbolism of a city comes from here. A city is organized. A city has communities that are, you know, it's able to house and to feed people and generally takes care of its inhabitants. Now, in most cases, a city also provides for other communities, communities far away from that particular city. There are opportunities for employment both within and without those cities. Business. There's this import and export of goods and services. It can be a hub, a place where people can gain transportation to many other areas, not just of that continent, but of the earth. Look at Denver Airport. People fly to different parts of the world from Denver. I'm not saying that Denver's that great city. I'm just making a comparison here. So Babylon the Great has long functioned in that way. And for this reason, it's prophesied that those who do not have the mark of the beast or the number of his name, that they will not be able to buy and sell. And if you can't buy and sell, you're pretty much dead in the water without God's support. You can't do anything. I mean, travel, what are you going to do? Now, when we examine the details of the history of tribes or nations, kings, empires, and their religious affiliation, we find a pattern connecting nearly all of them in a variety of ways to Babylon. So Babylon has long influenced and manipulated culture, commerce, bureaucracy, and of course particularly the religious practices of most people in the past, in the present, and also into the future. It has made a path for nations and prominent empires to rise and then fall and then rise and then fall over and over down through time. And it will become a world power once again. Now, it probably already is. And I say probably because it's not just yet manifest as something that we can point to and say, ah, there it is, that's the beast, that's the woman riding the beast, and that as the man of sin has been revealed. We can't say that right now, which is one of the final steps before the end of the age begins. But that false system has and will have more than one city. But like any state or any nation or empire, there is, of course, a capital city, which is a particularly busy hub of activity and resources, and it influences all parts of the body of that nation or empire. So many nations will enjoy, have enjoyed, and will enjoy the things that she has to offer. She will provide goods. She will provide services. She will provide housing and all kinds of things to people who have part with her, do business with her, just like China today. They support nations all around the world with their goods and services. And it's definitely not all positive. So her merchandising, it's not just food and clothing and electronics and housewares and precious metals and jewels, what have you. She markets lawless, that is, godless values. And she buys and sells evil, but gives it an appearance of something that is good and positive and even righteous. The next chapter, Revelation 18, this speaks of the coming fall of Babylon the Great. And I'm going to read several of the first verses here of chapter 18. Beginning in verse 1, "After these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen. And has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works in the cup which she has mixed double for her. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, and am no widow, and will not see sorrow. And therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire. For strong is the Lord God who judges her. There is much going on in the symbolism presented here of this angel executing God's judgment on Babylon the Great. Verses 2 and 3 that we had read, they repeat words that are found in chapter 14 of Revelation and in verse 8, where it says, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Now again, the description of Babylon being a great city, it is related to the functions of a city, a state, a government. It doesn't mean it has to be positive, and clearly it is not. However, there appears to be a connection to an actual place that is the capital, likely the capital city of Babylon the Great. Now, some might think or make a connection to maybe it's Vatican City, a government within a government. It may be that maybe that is what's being spoken of here. I do believe that Vatican City is connected in numerous ways, but what city will be Babylon's capital at the end of the age, that cannot be known for certain at this time. We can only speculate. What we know today as Catholicism, it is responsible for adopting numerous heretical pagan practices and giving them Christian names and symbols and feeding them to the world. Many have been spiritually intoxicated by the doctrine that became known as Catholicism. Hence, there is this symbolism here that we had read in verse 2 of chapter 17 of the wine of fornication in her cup and many drinking of this wine. Her influence has spread far and wide. Now it says in verse 5 of chapter 18 that her sins have reached unto heaven, and that means that her sins are numerous, so numerous, and God, he is aware of all of them. If he knows the number of hairs on your head and on my head, he knows of all the sins of Babylon the Great, and he will render unto her according to her works. Now it states that her plagues will come in one day. Now, it is possible that the term means that God's plagues will come upon her quickly, as in a day's worth of time. I don't think it means literally to 24-hour period, but they will come relatively fast. I think it likely refers to the day or year of God's vengeance. In Isaiah 34 and verse 8, it gives us a key to understanding the day of the Lord, which is one of the days of the Lord. That expression, day of the Lord, doesn't always refer to the same period of time. It simply refers to a time when God intervenes in the affairs of man. But Isaiah 34 and verse 8 does speak of that day of the Lord in the future, at the end of the age, where it says, the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of retribution for the cause of Zion. And so we understand that that will be the final year of Great Tribulation. The Great Tribulation will take period for more than 3.5 years, but the final year is going to be a time when there will be a year's worth of terrible plagues described as trumpet plagues and bowl plagues. And it's my understanding that included in that year, and I think all of us would agree, included in that final year is judgment on this mother of harlots and the beast. So that day or year, it will affect the entire world, but it will be particularly harmful to those people who have the mark of the beast, which again is another connection to Babylon the Great. Now, interestingly, in verse 8, we had read that the end of this city will be by fire. So she will be utterly burned, it says. There is a similar prophecy to that event that is found in Isaiah 34, verses 9 through 10. And I'm not going to turn there. But you know, it starts off in verse 8. I did quote that of the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of his retribution. And if you continue reading in Isaiah 34, in verse 9, it says, "Its streams shall be turned into pitch, and its dust into brimstone. Its land shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched day or night. Its smoke shall ascend forever from generation to generation. It shall lie waste. No one shall pass through it forever and ever." So it's talking about a particular area consisting of a particular people. And forever and ever at the end of that, that's Isaiah 34, verse 10, it's an expression, a term that can mean from age to age, from eon to eon, or it can mean never ending. However, once God creates a new heavens and earth, that's, you know, this is my opinion, I think it's doubtful that an ever-burning crater will continue to exist in the new earth. But during the millennium, it will have a place and a purpose, a place burning throughout that time as a reminder of what happened to Babylon the Great as a result of her sins. In Revelation 20, and verse 10, it says that the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and false prophet are, or were cast, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever, which I think is, again, that here I believe it is an expression meaning age to age. So I think it's talking about this place, this ever-burning place that will begin to burn when God destroys this area, which I think is a capital area, capital city, if you will, of Babylon the Great. If you go back into chapter 19, verses 2 and 3, it says, "For true and righteous are God's judgments, because he has judged the great harlot who corrupted the earth with her fornication, and he has avenged on her the blood of his servants shed by her." Again, they said, "Alleluia, her smoke rises up forever and ever." So it appears that a capital city of Babylon the Great will become a place that will burn continually. And, a lot of activity outdoors today. If they were only keeping the Sabbath. I suggest as a reminder of what she was responsible for and as a result of her judgment as to why God would want this to continually be burning for people to be able to see, and but not nobody would go to inhabit. There's another place where it describes certain wild and unclean animals living around this area in the future. And that's really the only purpose I can see of why God would want something like that to continue to exist during the time of the millennium. In the next verses, where we left off in Revelation 18, verses 9 and 10, I don't think I need to read all of them, but it tells of people mourning because of Babylon's fall. It speaks of merchants weeping because nobody will buy their merchandise any longer. And clearly, being a powerful world force, an empire influencing most of the world, that the collapse of that empire will result in the collapse of world economies. Livelihoods, life savings, those things will be lost. And people will be greatly disturbed to the point of great sorrow. Worldly possessions, which many people treasure so much, they will lose their value. The pleasures that many people enjoy will no longer be available to them. In addition, there is a description in the prophecy of associates being afraid, looking at it from a distance and being afraid to attempt to help that city because the destruction is so great. In verses 15 through 19 of Revelation 18, it says, "The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing.' Every shipmaster who travel by ship, sailors and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance. And they cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What is like this great city?'" In other words, it was just decadent. It was off the charts. And again, there's symbolism here. Will there be people watching? Yes, I think. But John is seeing something here describing what is going to take place, not just around that area, but likely around the world, of people being so sad at the destruction of that city and that empire. It says in verse 19, "They threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing, and saying, 'Alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she is made desolate.'" So powerful is Babylon the Great that it says her merchandise includes the bodies and souls of men. Now, in other words, what it means is she owns people. People have both willingly and people being coerced to commit their lives to her, to dedicate their lives to this woman and her empire. And also, she's taken many lives through war, through murder, through assassinations, and even by slavery. This has happened numerous times in the past. And it continues unto the end of the age. Oh, people like to think we're so sophisticated now, these types of things don't happen. But we know it's becoming blatantly clear that human trafficking, slavery today, it is a thing. People are killed today by those in power who are influenced by these ways of Babylon the Great. Now, mentioned in this prophecy are ships. Nations have long profited from ships going back and forth across the oceans, exchanges of goods and even of people. Today we have mega container ships that carry merchandise far and wide. And if you go on the internet and look up some of the pictures of the ships today with these storage containers, it is, wow, it makes your jaw drop. It's amazing how large. The largest of them today can carry over 20,000 TEUs. Now, I forget what the expression TEU means, but I think it means 20-foot something. Basically, what it refers to is a container, a storage. We've all seen these storage containers, these big metal containers that trucks carry around, that the average length of one of those is 20 feet. And so a ship that can carry 20,000 of those, can you imagine? Look at some pictures. It's impressive. Stacked who knows how many numbers high. You wonder how these things float. In any case, the description of ships in this prophecy is fitting for this reason. But remember that the book of Revelation, it is filled with symbolism. And I believe that there is a broader meaning of these ships, this description of sailors and merchants and what have you who trade on the sea. Now, verse 15 says that the waters which you saw, I'm sorry, this is chapter 17 and verse 15. It says, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And chapter 18 and verse 15 says that the merchants of these things became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment. So I suggest that these merchants with ships, that though real, that they do exist, they represent industrialized nations, nations who buy and sell and trade with Babylon. So most of the goods bought and sold by these nations, of course, would travel by sea. There's no other cost-efficient way to get them there. But I don't think that that is the only meaning of these ships. Jeremiah 51 Babylon the Great's fall was foretold by God long before the vision given to the Apostle John, and it was foretold through the prophet Jeremiah. And Jeremiah wrote this in Jeremiah 51 and verse 24. And actually, this entire chapter talks about it, but I want to read just a few verses of choice. Jeremiah 51, verse 24 says, I will repay Babylon and all the inhabitants of Chaldea for all the evil they have done in Zion in your sight, says the Eternal. Isn't that interesting? God says he's the one that's responsible for bringing Babylon down into Jerusalem to destroy that city. But then again, he says, I'm going to repay you for doing that. And it's because he allows things to happen, but he's not the inspiration of evil. And also, again, there's a bigger picture here of what the prophecy is talking about. Notice what it says in verse 25, behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain, who destroys all the earth. Did Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon of his time destroy all the earth? No. And I will stretch out my hand against you, roll you down from the rocks, and make you a burnt mountain. A mountain is representative of a government. And God says he is going to destroy them and make them a burnt mountain, as it talks about Babylon, that great city, being consumed by fire. In verse 26, they shall not take from you a stone for a corner, nor a stone for a foundation. In other words, you're not going to go start going through the rubble and gathering some things to use to rebuild. No. You shall be desolate forever, says the Eternal. Well, certainly Babylon was conquered in the 500s BC, but not forever. No, God even prophesied she would rise again and rise again and rise again. So most of this chapter, chapter 51 of the book of Jeremiah, speaks of Babylon's fall, and there are many parts that were fulfilled long ago, but this chapter has not been entirely fulfilled. There's a duality in it. And, Cyrus and Persia, he came down and conquered Babylon in approximately, well, he began before 539 BC, but he invaded the capital city of Babylon in 539 BC, and it was pretty much over after that. But the complete fulfillment of this prophecy is my point. It hasn't happened yet. Terms like forever cannot be applied yet. It's going to come. Revelation 18. We'd go back to Revelation. Hopefully you kept your ribbon there and you could turn quickly. So the prophecy we had read talks about many people being brokenhearted because of her fall. And I think it's not just going to be people that wheel and deal in goods, merchants, that there will be many people around the earth that will be very saddened by her fall. Perhaps they won't know her by her name, Babylon, or Mystery Babylon. They won't know her as the mother of harlots. But, she has not always carried those names in the past, in past regimes. They might know her as something else. Perhaps she will be known as Europe United. Maybe she'll be known as the Vatican. Maybe, some name we don't know yet. The name of the beast. Babylon is a multicultural system where ungodly values are practiced and promoted. And that is why God reminds genuine believers to come out of her, my people. To do not partake of her sins, lest you receive of her plagues. Because those Babylonian values, they are everywhere. They can be found everywhere around the world. That's how extensive her arms have reached. What those who mourn the destruction of Babylon do not realize is that God will return and he will begin to rebuild and restore the earth to its former glory. It will not include a restoration of Babylon at all, but of a different government, a government that has been practiced by few throughout the ages. And that is why God says in Revelation 18 and verse 20, rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. So this refers to angelic beings, but also saints, prophets, who should rejoice. And the rejoicing is not because of mass destruction. It's not because of all the lives of those people that will be lost when she is destroyed. But the rejoicing is because that will be a necessary tragedy, a necessary step to finally taking, for God taking hold of the earth and establishing his government. And then, ultimately, the opportunity for all those people whose lives were lost to have their chance for salvation. And that's a great thing. Lastly, there is a final destruction of Babylon's great city, or if I should say a final description of the destruction here of Babylon. In verses 21 through 24, then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down and shall not be found any more. The sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters shall not be heard in you any more. No craftsman or any craft shall be found in you any more, and the sound of a millstone shall not be heard in you any more. Everything will stop. The light of a lamp shall not shine in you any more, and the voice of bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, when by your sorcery all the nations were deceived. And in her, this mother of harlots, was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth. So this woman, the mother of harlots and her city, is symbolic. It's symbolic of a wretched system of rule and religion that has existed since the time of Nimrod. And she is responsible for murdering vast amounts of people, including prophets and saints, but not just in Jerusalem, in various parts of the world down through time. I mean, we have a few examples that are significant, such as the Crusades and the Inquisition. Those are examples of a false system that killed commandment keepers. Genuine Christians were slaughtered, tortured and slaughtered during those times, and they were done in the name of a paganized version of Christianity. One of the harlots of the mother. Or maybe I should say several harlots of the mother. So she has poured her abominations into the cups of millions for thousands of years. And it has affected, you know, some of the major religions of today, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and even many who claim to be Christian have drunk her fornication. The world has seen both rise and fall of the Babylonian system throughout history, while not knowing what it truly was, where it came from. In each fall, it never saw a complete end of her existence. In fact, those people who conquered these stages of that empire, eras, if you will, of that empire down through time, they were already participants of her ways when they conquered her. They assimilated. Jeremiah 51, once again, I want to read a couple more verses there that I think are interesting. Jeremiah 51. So the prophet Jeremiah, he told of her destruction, and we understand that was not entirely fulfilled by Persia. And notice a similarity to the final fulfillment described as a millstone being thrown into the sea in the book of Revelation. And in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 51 and verse 63, it says, "Now it shall be, when you have finished reading this book, that you shall tie a stone to it and throw it into the Euphrates." And this is being done as an acted oracle. Here's what it means. Verse 64, "Then you shall say, thus Babylon shall sink and not rise from the catastrophe that I will bring upon her. And they shall be weary." Thus are the words of Jeremiah. So we understand after the fall of Babylon by Cyrus and Persia that it did rise again. So this hasn't been fulfilled yet. Babylon has gone through a variety of changes down through time, both in regime and location. The ancient site of Babylon in Iraq today is a reminder of how impressive its beginning was. And then we have the imagery of a stone or a book in here being thrown into the depths of water, portraying Babylon's end, where it will not rise again. Ezekiel 26, if you go forward to the book of Ezekiel in chapter 26, this is where we will conclude, and I would like to read a few portions of God's prophecy about the king, prince, and city of Tyre. And we're familiar with the symbolism that is found in Ezekiel 28. It's something we have, all of us have likely heard read or read ourselves dozens of times, where it begins by describing this leader of Tyre, a prince or king, but we know it represents the devil because it says that he was in Eden, the garden of God, which the king of Tyre was not, and it says that he was the anointed cherub that was established at the mountain of God, meaning in God's government. Clearly the king of Tyre was not, and it says that he became filled with violence and committed unpardonable sins. So clearly Ezekiel 28 is talking about the devil. And when we consider the wickedness of Babylon the Great, we see that the devil had a large part to play and is hugely responsible for the establishment of Babylon the Great. Now notice that God, before he speaks of Satan's fate in Ezekiel 28, that, you know, personified as the king of Tyre, he tells of the city of Tyre's fate. And there's a striking similarity in what we are going to read between Tyre and the prophecies that we had read about the fall of Babylon in Revelation and also in Jeremiah 51. Now, I'm not going to read the entire chapter, but I want to read a portion of Ezekiel 26 and verse 15, beginning in verse 15, where it says, "Thus says the Lord God to Tyre, will the coastlands not shake at the sound of your fall, when the wounded cry when slaughter is made in the midst of you? And all the princes of the sea will come down from their thrones, lay aside their robes, and take off their embroidered garments, and they will clothe themselves with trembling, and they will sit on the ground and tremble every moment and be astonished at you." Sounds very much like, you know, what was going on, those people watching Babylon being destroyed from afar off, and just being afraid, scared, but saddened. Verse 17, "They will take up a lamentation for you and say to you, how have you perished, O one inhabited by seafaring men, a renowned city who is strong at the sea, she and her inhabitants who caused their terror to be on all her inhabitants. Now the coastlands tremble on the day of your fall. Yes, the coastlands by the sea are troubled at your departure." And these coastlands, it's referring to islands. And I'm not talking about small little islands, but though included, nations, continents. "They will be afraid because of this great destruction. For thus says the Lord God, when I make you a desolate city, like the cities that are not inhabited, when I bring the deep upon you and great waters cover you, I will bring you down with those who descend into the pit." Another similarity. "To the people of old I will make you dwell in the lowest part of the earth, in places desolate from antiquity, with those who go down to the pit, so that you may never be inhabited, and I shall establish glory in the land of the living. I will make you a terror, and you shall be no more, though you are sought for. You will never be found again, says the Lord God." Now, if you go into Ezekiel 27, and I'm going to read a few verses, again, describing the fall of this city, and it begins by talking about the lamentation that people will take up for the fall of Tyre. And there is a description of all the various things that people participated in. But verse 27 of chapter 27, it says, "Your riches, wares, and merchandise, your mariners and pilots, your caulkers and merchandisers, all your men of war who are in you, and the entire company which is in your midst, will fall into the midst of the seas on the day of your ruin. The common land will shake at the sound of the cry of your pilots, and all who handle the oar, the mariners, the pilots of the sea, will come down from their ships and stand on the shore, and they will make their voice heard because of you. They will cry bitterly, and cast dust on their heads. They will roll about in ashes. They will shave themselves completely bald because of you, gird themselves with sackcloth, and weep for you with bitterness of heart and bitter wailing. In their wailing for you, they will take up a lamentation and lament for you. What city is like Tyre, destroyed in the midst of the sea? Does that sound familiar? What about those merchants or mariners or what those people from the ships? What city is like this great city as they stood and watched Babylon fall? Verse 33, when your wares went out by the sea, you satisfied many people. You enriched the kings of the earth with your many luxury goods and your merchandise. But you are broken by the seas and the depths of the waters. Your merchandise and the entire company will fail in your midst. All the inhabitants of the isles will be astonished at you. Their kings will be greatly afraid, and their countenance will be troubled. The merchants among the peoples will hiss at you, and you will become a horror and be no more forever. Now this, when you know, you could read both of these chapters, 26 and 27, and find a number of similarities that are uncanny when comparing it to prophecies of Revelation 17, 18, and Jeremiah 51. And in fact, while we were working on the book, Satan's Fate, I had researched the ancient city of Tyre and its king at that time. And the record of Tyre's history does not account for the destruction that is talked about here. This is even noted by, well, they don't admit that part of it, but the InterVarsity Press Bible Background Commentary says this about Tyre. It says, according to Josephus, the Babylonian siege of Tyre lasted 13 years. A Babylonian text claims that Nebuchadnezzar was present during the siege. Apparently, the long siege ended with a treaty stipulating that the Tyrian royal house was to be deported to Babylon. Although the king of Tyre was allowed to stay, he was under the control of a Babylonian commissioner. So this man that was the king, he became known, he was demoted, if you will, and became known as the prince of Tyre later. And it says, so he was discharged from his position, relieved of his trust, and publicly humiliated. So Tyre was taken by Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. He plundered its goods. He reduced the authority of its king. However, the city was not completely destroyed. Not like God describes here. The king was never burned to death, as is spoken of Satan in Ezekiel 28. It shows us that these prophecies are talking about a future time. Now, regarding Tyre, 250 years after Nebuchadnezzar had taken that port, Alexander the Great conquered Tyre. And still, though, the city was not reduced to rubble. It was not destroyed. It remained to be a profitable seaport. In fact, you can go on the internet and you can look at pictures of Tyre, the ancient area of Tyre today, and it still stands. Off the coast of Lebanon, it's still a bustling harbor. It's far from being forsaken forever, as God describes. And this is because Ezekiel was not prophesying about the literal area of Tyre. That person, the prince of Tyre, the king, and that place, it represents Babylon. It represents its true king, which is the devil. It foretells of Satan's fate and ultimately the destruction of Satan's creation, Babylon the Great.